The robins are long gone from some parts of the country. They're rocking somewhere that's warmer. Other birds, well, aren't faring as well as the climate warms up. That's one of the topics on this week's edition of Jet Streaming. Hello, feather weather geeks. Welcome to Jet Streaming. I'm Kathy Werzer, head geektress. Is that a word, geektress?
It is now.
Okay. All right. I like that. Meteorologist Paul Huttner with us. Climatologist Mark Seely. Good to see you both.
Good to see you, Kathy.
Good to be here. Don't ask me to spell that.
No, you won't. I won't do that. By the way, you still have your little voice thing.
Just a little bit. Got a drought in my voice box.
Well, you're doing better than you did last week, and I'm glad you're with us. Well, in the past, you two, we've talked about the IPCC's reports on climate change. And we've debated the contention that global warming is a hoax. That was quite a show, Paul.
That was a good one.
With John Coleman.
Yeah.
Why don't we focus attention today on the possible effects of climate change on certain species? And birds come to mind. The reason? Our next guest, Carol Henderson, was with me recently on the radio talking about his new book. And he mentioned how scientists can study climate change and its effects on birds. And, you know, I couldn't pass up a chance to have you guys meet Carol Henderson. Carol is the non-game wildlife supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and author of a bunch of books, including his latest Oology. Did I get that right? Oology and Ralph's Talking Eggs.
That's right.
How are you, Carol?
Just fine. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, welcome to Jet Streaming. Now, let's talk about this book, which outlines your discovery of this huge bird egg collection of an Iowa man, 4,000 bird eggs, some dating back to 1875?
Right. This was just an absolutely incredible worldwide collection of birds ranging from the Bering Sea all the way to South Georgia Island by Antarctica, South Russia, all over Europe, and south to Argentina. And what happened is that was a popular hobby 100 years ago. It was perfectly legal. There were no good binoculars. There were no good bird books. So the way that people expressed their love of birds was to collect their eggs and then label them and create these collections like people might collect stamps or butterflies. And because of the really detailed observations they made, like when the incubation was started, when their nesting season was, and then the collection of these eggs so that they were actually accidentally preserving albumen and yolk material inside of these eggs after they blew them out, they ended up preserving DNA from back into the late 1800s. And so with the DNA material and the phenological observations, we now have a baseline of information that modern scientists can use to compare with modern bird populations and what's happening with them.
Mm. I wonder what you would find if you compare the two.
Well, I think one thing that's already happened is that we're finding that birds are arriving back from migration somewhat earlier and they're starting their nesting season earlier, and that the range of some of the birds is extending farther northward, the birds of the mixed hardwood forest, and even up on the edges of the possible nesting range for birds like the tundra swan and the trumpeter swan in the Northwest Territories and Alaska, the ranges of those birds are pushing farther north because they have a longer period of frost-free days for hatching their eggs and raising their young ones.
Carol, I have a pragmatic question that just struck me. This collection that's over 100 years old, it occurs to me that you'd want to preserve that by controlling the environment a little bit. Does a bird egg collection have to be in a certain kind of environment?
Yes. In this case, the collection was placed in two huge chests of drawers, and every little clutch of eggs was seated in a little bed of red cedar sawdust. And the aromatic qualities of the red cedar has kept out any insect damage. And because the eggs were blown out, they didn't decompose. So even just sitting in that old farmhouse all these years, it was just like stepping into a collection in the Smithsonian Institution. And since then, the farmer family, the Hansacker family of Colo, Iowa, have donated this to the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Yale University.
What a treasure that is.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, you know, because I bet when you walked into that farmhouse, knowing you, Carol, you probably went, my goodness.
Oh, I did. I was just almost speechless because there were all of these bird eggs from all over the world. There was all of this data. And the other thing is that there's this really intricate beauty of these eggs when you see them up close, all of the intricate markings that leave you really impressed by the macro art within the eggs themselves. So there was the artistic aspect of the beauty of the eggs. And then there was a scientific value of the data from the eggs. And so when I saw how big the collection was, I just knew that I had to do something to preserve this collection. And first I took pictures of every set of eggs. I photographed every data tag. And then as I started looking into all of this information, this story started to evolve. And that's where the story of Ralph's Talking Eggs came from, that the eggs had a story to tell about the people who collected them and the birds that laid them.
And maybe, as you say, using the baseline data for research on climate change somewhere along the line.
Yes, that too.
Carol, I'm curious about the birds that I see around here this time of year in winter. You know, I've always wondered what species, if any, winter over in Minnesota. I always see them around. Is it true that only some members of a species may choose to stay behind? I've heard that some robins stay here all winter, and I'm wondering if our climate change may affect any of those birds that winter over here.
Oh, yes. This has been a big change in recent years. In the past, a lot of the birds that stay here either ate seeds or they eat meat or fat, animal fat, like from dead animals. The birds that often will migrate are the ones that either eat insects, like warblers. They go to Central and South America. Or they scratch on the ground for food, like towhees. But the other birds that are kind of the swing species that can go either way are the ones that eat fruits, like robins and bluebirds. And even mourning doves now, with the mild winters we've had more and more doves that stay north. But the bluebirds and the robins, people will see those. And this is probably a mixed aspect where the winters have been milder, but then also people have been planting a lot of fruiting trees and shrubs and vines where they can find more food now than they might have in the past under a natural forest condition.
When it comes to various species that, and I know you study this on a regular basis, Carol, are there species that you worry a little bit about when it comes to climate change and their future?
I think in the central part of the country here, we're not dealing with endemic species that might be extremely rare. I think where the concern comes is that Minnesota has a very large segment of boreal forest, northern coniferous forest in the northeast quadrant of the state, St. Louis County, Lake and Cook counties. And there are unique species of that boreal forest system, like boreal chickadees, spruce grouse, Canada jays, or gray jays. And as the winters become more mild and change the climate, the tree composition of the forest will shift, and we may see a shifting of mixed hardwood forest moving farther north and the boreal forest receding into Canada, so that the extent of the forest, the composition of the forest and tree and shrub species, and the kinds of birds that we call Minnesota birds may be shifting farther north across the border. And I don't know that we've seen that yet, but I think that would be part of the trend that we would expect from these broad changes.
Or do you also see the case, like I'm thinking that the little hummingbird that was found in Wisconsin, little guy who is normally seen like in South America or something like that, and someone thought, well, he was blown off course. Well, if some birders think that the little guy just kind of liked Wisconsin and figured, hey, this was not too bad, and was doing just fine. I mean, can you see a day where you might see some of these very odd species show up and then do fairly well in a climate?
The kind of birds you're talking about are the accidental birds. These are like the lone ranger that shows up someplace it's not supposed to be, and then it freezes to death because it's in the wrong place. Yeah. But we do see this shift occurring with some birds. There are some species that have been shifting their range farther north where they're coming across the border. When Roberts did his book, Birds of Minnesota, in 1934, there were no nesting great egrets, the big, beautiful white egrets. Mm-hmm. Not a single one nesting in the state. And now they're all the way up through Fergus Falls and almost the southern half of Minnesota as a nesting species. There were no blue grosbeaks mentioned in Robert's book, and now they're nesting in the southwest part of the state. And we may see the incursion of other species like the rufous-sided towhee moving up from the southeastern part of the state. The tufted titmouse would be another one that would be a more southerly bird moving northwards. Someday we might see Mississippi kites nesting in southwest Minnesota. So, just over 100 years ago, that was when the cardinals first started showing up in Minnesota. And now they're showing up all the way through central Minnesota, and we're getting scattered reports from up on the North Shore and northwestern Minnesota. So the boundary edges of these species ranges is a very dynamic thing. And the climate change is something where it's more important than ever for people to keep notes on when they see these things, because that's a reflection of what climate does. The possum, another example where I've seen them all the way up towards Hinckley, Mille Lacs Lake, And when I first started working with the DNR 30 years ago, they were just in the very southeastern part of Minnesota.
Yeah, I wondered also, you talk about extended range, you talk about migration. I can't help but wonder if there won't be change in the diseases that afflict birds. For example, I'm quite well aware from working with my university colleagues that avian pulmonary virus in turkeys is a weather-related disease. And I can't help but think that there'll be some disease elements that will come into play with these bird populations as well.
Well, I think you're very right, and I think that might be a much bigger component of climate change than we ever thought about. We think about the conspicuous, obvious species that we like, but a year ago, my wife and I led a birdwatching tour in Kenya and Tanzania, and in the past, malaria was only a problem in the lowlands near the coast, like Mombasa, other places like that. But now, with the warmer climate, even in Kenya, the mosquitoes, the Anopheles mosquitoes that carry malaria, have moved their range upward to the elevation of Nairobi. And when you get malaria into a city like Nairobi, it can be affecting millions and millions of people. And so there you're not just dealing with animal range changes, but you're dealing with diseases that can affect animals, birds, people, a whole gamut. And so the entomological aspects of range changes and climate change are, I think, going to be a very, very big component of how we need to address these issues and understand that it's a really big picture, and it's going to take a lot of people addressing this at different levels to understand what's happening.
Oh, that is another discussion for another day. Carol Henderson, thanks for coming all the way in here and talking with us.
You're sure welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Carol Henderson is with the Minnesota DNR. Watching football on a crisp, dry fall evening can be a lot of fun. Watching football in an ice storm, not so much.
It was December 1st, 19... Let's try that again. It was December 31st, 1967. The Green Bay Packers and the Dallas Cowboys played in the coldest game in NFL history. And it's a game that's written about in a book written by David Moranis. That voice that I pitifully tried to do, they call him the voice of God. I forget what his name is.
Howard Cosell.
He does a lot of those NFL things. The book is called When Pride Still Mattered, The Life of Vince Lombardi. David, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you all this morning. It was John Facenda was the voice of God.
Okay. John Facenda.
There
I
you
knew
go.
You'd know, David. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
David, that game, 13 below the temperature at kickoff, the wind chill 48 below, if I understand correctly. Is that still the coldest game in NFL history? Have any others come that close?
It's not the coldest in NFL history. There was a Cincinnati Bengals game that was 19 below, at least, which was surprising in that it was in Cincinnati, far south of Green Bay. But no other game had the combination of importance and atmosphere and frigidity that the Ice Bowl had. So it's the one that stands in football and American lore.
Well, of course, back then, the technology wasn't what it is today in terms of Thinsulate and some of these fabrics, as well as ways to stay warm on the sideline. Was Lambeau Field frozen solid like a piece of concrete?
It was, and the funny part is that Vince Lombardi, who was the head coach and general manager of the Packers in that era, had purchased an electrified blanket that went under the field, and so this would be its first test, and it failed miserably. It didn't work at all. The field was completely frozen. The funny thing is he bought that contraption from the son of George Halas, who was the coach and owner of the Chicago Bears, his chief rivals. I don't know if it was anything suspicious, but it didn't work.
I recall Bud Grant, the old head coach of the Vikings, would never let his players use hand warmers on the sidelines. Was Vince Lombardi kind of similar to Bud Grant?
Yeah, he was sort of. He had a rule that none of the players who would ever touch the ball could wear gloves. But one of the Packers, a linebacker named Dave Robinson, who was black, convinced the trainer to just give him some brown gloves and nobody would know the difference. So he's the one guy who got away with wearing some gloves that day, but nobody else could. And the Cowboys, you know, the opposition that day is important. It was the Dallas Cowboys, you know, from sunny Texas. And they had a great wide receiver named Bob Hayes, who was the world's fastest human and won an Olympic gold medal in the dashes, and he was their best receiver. And the Packers said when they saw Hayes come out and stick his hands in his pants to try to warm up, they knew they had the game won.
David, how did now I know you've written and studied Vince Lombardi a lot, but how did he prepare? He must have anticipated what the weather would be like.
Well, they actually didn't. The day before, it was 20 degrees above zero, and the weather forecasters had predicted that it would be 30 that day. So it was a drop of more than 40 degrees that the weathermen of that era missed somehow. I don't know how that could happen. But it did, so they weren't quite prepared for that bitter weather. But to play in Green Bay, you of course have to practice, and you know, starting sometime in November, it's like it could be like that any day. So usually they had the advantage over their opponents, except for the Bears and the Vikings, when the Vikings played outdoors, in being accustomed to that sort of weather. And so they had the right sort of cleats for which the ground was frozen. They had, you can't really train for 16 below or a 48 degree wind chill, though. There's nothing to prepare you for that.
That's for sure. I think that forecast was in the day before computer models, too.
I think it was.
You know, David, I've heard a lot of great anecdotes about things that went on that day at Lambeau. Packers fans several times during the contest leaning over the front row to unplug the Cowboys' heated benches. Any truth to that one?
That one is not true.
That one is not true.
There's a lot of mythology about the Ice Bowl. I've often said, you know, I talked to, interviewed many, many fans for my book and just asked them questions about what they wore that day. But if everybody who claims they were at the Ice Bowl really was there, it'd be, you know, would have been 2 million people. Because basically everybody in Wisconsin says, oh, yeah, I was there. You
know? How about
But some things are true. Frank Gifford was the color announcer. And he really did say on the air, I think I'll take another bite of my coffee.
Yeah. How about the fans? I mean, the players at least were running around and trying to stay warm. The fans must have had it rough.
You know, they were as a mixed bag as any group of fans. Some women literally came to the game in high heels and fur coats.
Oh, for goodness
sakes. Unbelievable as that is. But many others were totally prepared. In my book, I wrote about a guy named Bob Kaminsky, who lived in Two Rivers, one of those tough, cold towns up in on the Door County, and he said, asked him, "What'd you wear?" And he said, "This is what I wore: long johns, work shoes. Over the work shoes, I put these heavy gray woolen socks that came over the knees, a pair of galoshes over that, flannel pajamas over the long johns, work overalls over the pajamas, a T-shirt, a flannel shirt, insulated sweatsuit, heavy parka, face mask with holes for mouth and eyes, wool tassel cap, and then he climbed into a sleeping bag."
And he had a flask with him, too.
I'm sure he did.
Don't think he didn't.
Yep.
David, can I ask, along the lines Paul was asking, is it true that the critical point in the game when Bart Starr scored the winning touchdown, that was supposed to be a handoff, but with everybody with numb hands, he decided, he didn't even tell his teammates, he just decided to keep it?
That is true. He told a couple of the linemen, but he didn't tell the fullback, Chuck Merced, who thought he was getting the ball. And there's no quarterback sneak in the Packer playbook in that era. So Starr went over to the sidelines, talked to Lombardi. Lombardi said, "Run whatever the hell you want to, but let's get out of here." And Starr kept the ball and, you know, scored that iconic touchdown to win the game with Merced thinking he was getting the ball. And so there's some famous pictures of Merced actually jumping over Starr with his hands out. And it's because he thought he was getting the ball and didn't want to bump into Starr.
And what was the final score of that game?
21-17.
That's a great story. What a good book. I'm so glad you joined us, too,
okay,
David.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care of yourself.
You.
Likewise. Yep, David Marinus, and the book is called When Pride Still Mattered, The Life of Vince Lombardi. We had so much fun last week talking about appropriate holiday gifts for weather geeks. We thought we'd pass along some more. I have one, you guys. How about a digital handheld wind gauge with flashlight?
Yes.
Yeah. I want that, says Paul Huttner. It's from theweathershop.com, by the way. You might want to check that out. I don't know.
I'm coming back at you with books again, Kathy, but Gail Gibbons, who's a children's book author, has written a number of books about the weather specifically. And one of her best sellers is Weather Forecasting for Children.
Ooh.
And I've seen this book, and it's got some very good tips in it that children could this would be for elementary age. So for parents out there of younger children, any book about the weather by Gail Gibbons, but particularly Weather Forecasting, would be a good read.
I think I'll get that myself. Thank you.
Yeah. Here's a book for kids, too, that I love. It's called The Weather Wizard's Cloud Book. And it has all kinds of great pictures of the clouds. It classifies the clouds. You can even do some forecasting based on some of the clouds. So find that one, Weather Wizard's Cloud Book. It's a good little stocking stuffer.
You know, Carol Henderson has been patient in sitting here in studio with us. Would you recommend any specific book for holiday giving?
Well, there are a couple of books. One is Oology and Ralph's Talking Eggs. You can learn all about the history of our conservation of wild birds in North America. And then there's another brand new book out that's just a wonderful one for young people and adults both. And it's called Wild About Minnesota Birds by Adele Porter. And this is really a fun book. It has lots of color. It has 69 different common species featured by their habitat. And it has a lot of really fun facts, like weather-related. I'll bet you didn't know that the gray jay has a strategy for starting to nest earlier than any other bird in the northern part of Minnesota because it has sticky spit.
Oh,
in late summer, it catches little bugs, kills them, and sticks them to tree bark. And then they dry up like little raisins, but the protein content is still there, the fat content still there. And in the middle of winter, they'll go back and retrieve their little bugs off the tree bark, and it turns their reproductive system into high gear so they can start nesting because they've got the nutrition they need before any of the other birds up there.
See, the things you learn on Jetstream A.
Talk about adapting to your environment.
Exactly. Wild About Minnesota Birds. Thank you, Carol.
By Adele Porter.
I like that. Not exactly weather-related. Well, there are weather tidbits, but, you know, fun and educational.
Good stuff.
I like that. See, before we go, a weather website of the week. I'm going to take a stab at this. Actually, it's an easy one. It's Carol Henderson's site, hendersonbirding.com. I'm going to get out of here. How about you guys? You want to join me?
Yeah, I got to go shovel snow.
Yeah, there you go. Your wife is just calling. She wants to talk with you about that.
Bread and milk and the shovel.
There you go. Mark Seeley, take care of that voice, by the way.
I will. Thanks, Kathy.
And we'll see you next week. That's going to wrap up Jet Streaming for the week. If you have a question or comment about Jet Streaming, don't be shy. Drop us a line at minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Jet Streaming. And by the way, thanks to folks like Amber from Arkansas for doing just that. I just love knowing where our listeners are. For Jet Streaming, I'm Kathy Werzer. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky. Keep on the sun.